All right. Hey, Toby.
Hey, Andrew.
So this is episode 2
of
our show. We're going to do the little spot. I'm going to change the music this time because I realized that, like, I was using music that, like, I don't own for our first episode, which made me freak out a little bit.
Well, as nobody finds out about it.
Right. As long as no one finds out about it, we're good. So this, from here on out, I'm just going to use music that we can use legally without getting in trouble. I think that's probably a good idea. I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is The Office Hour. So before we get started, we have a little advisory to our listeners. Some of the topics we may discuss today what do they say in This American Life? They acknowledge the existence of sex. And there may be some, you know, some kind of serious content. So, you know, if you're listening with kids in the car or something, you might want to hold off on that and listen to this.
Put on your wireless Apple headphones.
Yeah, put on those wireless Apple headphones. Today we have a guest on The Office Hour.
Our first guest.
It's our first guest, our first of what is hopefully many guests. And our guest today is Dr. Anna Ioannis, who is, like Toby and I, a Britain fellow in the Writing and Communication program here at Georgia Tech. And the occasion of our interview is the publication in Signs, which is a journal of women in culture and society, published by the University of Chicago. This is in volume 42, number 1. This is what the September issue?
Yeah.
The September issue, it is an article titled Shock and Consent in a Feminist Avant-Garde. Kathleen Hanna reads Kathy Acker. So, Anna, we would like to welcome you to our show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Toby and I have not really prepared anything except the fact that we are going to approach this from a kind of good cop, bad cop angle.
That's the plan.
Nice.
Toby has decided he wants to be the bad cop, which means I will be the good cop.
So my first question is, why should anybody care about this at all?
Wow, you are bad. I actually think that answer is pretty obvious. Sexual violence is a huge issue that we're dealing with in our culture right now. And maybe the sort of the real answer to that is that I also think so much of our understanding of sexual violence is mediated through different kinds of representations. That's not a super groundbreaking thing to say, but like, I think reading matters, and that's what I'm trying to talk about.
And so maybe for just a sec, summarize the particular material you're talking about.
Yeah, I looked at the relationship between a musician, performer, writer, Kathleen Hanna, who's the lead singer of the Riot Grrrl band Bikini Kill, and the influence of the avant-garde punk feminist writer Kathleen Hanna on her, as they both managed Kathy Acker.
Yeah,
thank you.
They're both Kathys.
Yeah, it's sort of confusing. So in Kathy Acker's novel Blood and Guts in High School, she has a lot of violent representations of sexual violence, of incest, of rape, of abortion. And so I'm really interested in the way that readers feel when they read those things. And I'm making the argument that those representations are shocking in their violence, but that shock is not simply, doesn't simply shut us down and distance us from the thing that we're reading, right? The example of Kathleen Hanna's relationship to Acker really demonstrates that these difficult images and scenes can actually elicit feelings of love, attachment, community, recognition, and that really kind of complicates our picture of what it means to read, let's say, triggering material.
And so, as a sidebar to this then, because it seems like you're translating some material into reading that's come from traditionally visual representations of sexual violence, and is it different then, if somebody's in a movie, they're kind of trapped in a way, right? This sort of Hitchcock idea of being like held in your seat in a dark room kind of thing. But in a book, you could just put the book down. So, I mean, can it translate that sort of like forced to intake sexual violence?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good question. And it's something that I want to keep thinking about.
I mean, you can always walk out of a movie that way.
Yeah. And some of us have.
Some of us. I don't know if Toby has ever walked out of a movie.
I walked out of the Kevin Costner Robin Hood as a child.
That's pretty good.
And in near the beginning, there's a scene where there's a body suspended, a skeleton suspended in a cage over a moat. And I was like, I'm out of here. And so I left and I went and watched What About Bob instead.
That was a good choice.
Yeah, that seems like a good call. So I actually think that reading is a little bit, because you might not walk out of a movie, but you can close your eyes, right? And I do, my interest in this topic actually comes from the fact that I'm a pretty squeamish person, and some of my most memorable and powerful reading experiences and film viewing experiences have been difficult ones, you know, that are about covering my eyes or closing the book. But I think in reading, the sort of temporal aspect of that negotiation is really different. Like, yes, you can close the book, but it seems to me that you're kind of constantly renegotiating what you can take in the reading moment, right? So, if we kind of think about it as a pretty fine-grained experience, it's like, where does your eye stop, right?
I'm a Victorianist, and so one of the things that's prominent is Dickens used to give all these speeches. He used to do the readings of his novels, and his favorite reading to do was the violent beating death of Nancy in Oliver Twist. And this is actually what some say is the thing that killed him, was that he was sick and he was proceeded to do like an extremely energetic version of this reading and basically killed himself. And the way he talks about it is he sort of fetishized seeing the reactions of the people that he would read this violent, you know, romantic death scene to. How does shock resist something like fetishization? Or, like, becoming just part of a kind of sexual narrative that someone like Dickens could own?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, like, one of the sort of broad, or one of the sort of typical reads on Kathy Acker is that what she's really doing is, you know, she's not describing, she's describing whatever sexual violence that's really quotidian, right? And then she uses this sort of, like, whatever her kind of over-the-top aesthetic strategies, her use of collage and a sort of childlike but aggressive vocabulary is about kind of defamiliarizing the violence that just subsumes our everyday lives, right? So, I mean, I think that's the thing, right? Like, it's totally pervasive in our culture that violence against women, against other sort of marginalized people, is mainstream and fetishized and pleasurable, right? Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah. I'm stealing one of my wife's stories, Candace Wilson. She's a professor at University of North Georgia. And a couple years ago, she was teaching the piano, if you've seen that Jane Campion film, to her students. And there's a scene in which the kind of scare quotes good husband finds out that his wife is sleeping with another man. He runs down and she's a pianist and she doesn't speak. And so she kind of speaks with her fingers and he chops off her finger. And my wife looked for the students to be kind of horrified by this and asked her the defense. And her students felt like she deserved it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, she couldn't have been more surprised.
Yeah.
That like, the sort of ethic in the classroom was, no, like, she's a whore, chop her fingers off.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I had a pretty similar teaching experience a number of years ago when I was teaching that, the story that's based on the Bob Dylan song by Joyce Carol Oates. Do y'all, where are you going? Where are you going? Where have you been? And there's an attack on a young woman that my students were like, well, she was egging him on. She's an unlikable character. And that's another thing that, like, you know, I don't know. It's a big, big topic, right? To think about what's happening, how we're relating to characters in novels or films for that matter, in terms of thinking about kind of real world violence, right, and behavior.
A lot of the argument that you're making in this wonderful article, which all of our listeners should read, by the way, is this sort of like anti-pornography, like point of view in what I understand to be like second wave feminism, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering what kind of resonances of this kind of feminist shock discourse do you see in like more contemporary feminist discourse that, I don't know, from my understanding anyway, has sort of moved beyond this kind of anti-pornography thing that was very caught up in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this, I mean, the article is part of a special issue that is reassessing the quote-unquote sex wars of the feminist movement in the late 70s and early 80s, right? There's this pretty famous, infamous conference at Barnard College called Pleasure and Danger, and that's also the title of this issue. So it's about reassessing that question of the relationship between pleasure and danger, because there was kind of this break in the feminist movement, in the sort of second wave feminist movement, between the sort of sex positive mode and this anti-pornography vein, you know, Andrea Dworkin, Mary Daly, Catherine MacKinnon, that like really, you know, I mean, the diagnosis of the pervasiveness of rape culture, I guess, kind of sounds like what I've been talking about, but clearly I'm not aligned with the anti-pornography feminists. So, yeah, and I would say, you know, a number of articles in the issue do sort of look backwards to that moment, but others really think about that, like, to finally answer your question, I don't think that debate is sort of breaking down like a debate in the same way right now. It's not like, oh, there's an anti-pornography vein and a sex positive feminism is pretty normative, right? And I would say that contemporary conversations around that are more about critiquing the limitations of that approach to sexuality, right? Particularly as it relates to sort of intersections of identity. In what ways is a sex positive approach to feminist identity prescribed or dependent on, you know, being a pretty normative woman, right? Like being white or being thin, or, you know, like sort of who is sex positive feminism for? I think is like a question that is taking up the same issues now.
The methodology of your article is you're creating a kind of genealogy, right? Maybe it's just a two-person genealogy here, but it's Kathy Acker, Kathleen Hanna. Are there other writers, other feminist writers you see as sort of continuing this Acker Hanna tradition? I mean, you cite that Believer article that Chris Krauss wrote. I mean, I would be inclined to like put I Love Dick, for instance, in this like Blood and Guts in High School, like Kathleen Hanna zine tradition. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. I mean, this is a little bit to just swing over somewhere else, but like, to me, the biggest and most famous kind of figure that is really sort of fucking in an interesting way with questions about identity
Finally.
I don't know if I can say that.
No, man, finally get to the explicit content.
You knew it was
this
coming.
Is good.
Maybe you should cut that out. But
maybe.
We'll
see.
The contemporary cultural figure that most ably critiques formations of sexuality in complicated ways is Kara Walker, to me, right? And that's in a pretty different... I'm not sure I would put her in that genealogy, but the way she manages, this wide range of emotional resonances in relationship to violence and symbolic violence, I think she's doing really complicated things with... Yeah, with those issues, but Chris Cross.
Chris. Have you watched the TV show?
Not yet. No,
you have to. It's so good.
It's really good.
I love Catherine Hahn. She's just wonderful.
It's like Catherine Hahn's moment right now.
Oh,
too.
I hope her moment continues.
We've been
forever.
Waiting so long.
So you have these feminist artists who are deploying shock. Can you, as a feminist scholar, is there any way for you to use shock in your own work?
I mean, I think you're, as a teacher, you're modulating shock all the time, right? Now it's based on what Toby and I have been talking about, it's mostly like your own shock that your students are not shocked by things that should be shocking. But
what's the most shocked your students have ever been by something in the classroom?
Mm.
If they indeed have ever been shocked.
Mm. Well, I mean, my research really comes out of a moment in the classroom a number of years ago at this point, like pretty green teacher, where I assigned Kathy Acker and I didn't...
Was it Blood and Guts in high school?
No, it was just a section of Great Expectations,
okay.
Which is incredibly violent and disturbing. And like, you know, I didn't set it up enough or in the way that I should have. And I'm not even sure I should have assigned it at this point. But it was really a testament to my students that they were like... they were like, yeah, we were really upset when we read this.
But then if you had set it up, then they wouldn't have had that experience.
Yeah,
right?
Well, it would have. Like, yeah, I mean, maybe so. I mean, I think there are some representations that are still really upsetting, even if you know you're about to be upset by them. But yes, that's true. Like, there is that more total shock effect, I guess, of being surprised by something you didn't know was coming. And I just was really lucky to have a great group of students where we talked about ways in which, like, you know, the reading was, whether it was valuable for them to have had that reading experience. I mean, they ended up saying it was, right? But only in relationship to also discussing it.
Which is interesting because I feel like we're in a moment in academia right now where teachers are getting, like, Title IX complaints or fired over profanity,
mm-hmm.
or, right, like,
mm-hmm.
that exactly the kind of discovery you're discussing seems to be now not just dangerous in the text, but dangerous professionally in the classroom for you to participate in.
Which surely has at least something to do with the casualization of academic labor, right, and the way power is organized around that's a real thing.
I think for me, I had this experience several years ago when I was taking a seminar in Karl Marx in graduate school, and we were reading all of Capital Volume 1 and then sections of 3 and the Gundisa and this kind of stuff, and I remember looking around at some point and being like, shit, Karl Marx is he's really dead now, because no one cares that the seminar on him is being taught, right? That, like, in a way, if people are trying to stop you from doing something, then that something is probably a real thing.
Yeah. And I think that, like, to come back to your question of, like, shock in scholarship, professionalism, I mean, we're having this conversation, it seems to me, right now, in terms of the hermeneutics of suspicion, right? Like,
that's going to be the title of this episode. I just decided.
Yeah, well, and your next article.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
because, well, I'm cribbing from Rita Felsky again, but it's so critique, right, is her word. But, I mean, it seems like you always disable the shock effect when you're in command of a reading, right, or of a body of information. So I don't quite know what it looks like to, I mean, if you have mastery over an object of study, can it shock you? I'm not sure.
You have to be vulnerable.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I will say that last winter I was in the archives at Duke looking at Acker's papers, and what was surprising about them was like the sort of like I'm looking at like postcards and things with like cats on the front and like texting my sister these like pictures of her weird like letters and stuff, you know, and that like this, so it's kind of ironic that there's like this deep humanizing and normalizing effect that comes out of that archival experience in relate, like that's the like the way in which I could become, I guess, vulnerable to a new aspect of this text and author that I've been reading, right? Which is a weird, like, the archival and the biographical are like a pretty old school aspect of literary scholarship.
I think we're running out of time, but I have one more question for you, which is a question that Kathleen Hanna famously asked, which is, what's your take on Cassavetes? Misogynist? Genius?
I don't actually know.
Alcohol? Okay,
oh, wait,
whatever.
Oh, yeah. Wait, is he the guy who did he do Gloria?
Yeah, he did Gloria.
And Woman Under the Influence?
Yeah.
I just watched Woman Under the Influence.
You just watched Woman Under the Influence?
Holy shit.
We should talk about that next
yeah.
week.
Wow. Yeah, let's talk about that.
Thank you very much, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
nice
of course. Come back soon.
The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson Bates, Burton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening.